session number 22084, reel 13.
This is the seventh taped interview with Keith Potter in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 27th of the 6th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. You were talking about refusing to work for the Germans, having fought them all this way. How was that seen by the other men in camp? How were you treated by them as a result of your choice that you had?
I don't think it made any difference to them. I think every man had his own opinion. Some volunteered, some didn't. Whatever the choice was, it was the individuals. I couldn't condemn other people because they'd taken the other route, because I could understand some of the motivation that would cause them to do it. But it didn't motivate me enough to do it. I couldn't get over my own conscience in that matter. So it's very much a personal thing. Right through my POW experience, in all honesty, I can remember no difficulty with people at all. No difficulty.
You wanted to discuss, and I was going to ask you a question of one of the main things that a prisoner of war has to cope with is boredom. You mentioned some of the things that you did to relieve that boredom, but escape. You wanted to talk about your thoughts of escape at this point.
Yes. It is quite true that every soldier, worth his salt anyway, has thoughts of escape in his mind. And I described earlier that right from the time that I was first taken in the desert, I had thoughts of escape and constantly viewed my life as looking for opportunities to escape. And I had a compass made for me. I had a map, different maps made, and one or two of them I still have here, showing escape routes and showing rivers and things like that. And a lot of people attempted escape, and some quite successfully. The ones on working camps at the time of Italy's collapse found it a lot easier because they were outside, they could get moving. Getting past the Calcutta barrier was a bit different. And then moving into Austria, into the Alps, was a problem of its own, because we were in what they referred to, or what was referred to as the snow hole of Europe, and that is Spittal and then Marktpongau. To move out of that area, firstly you had to scale a Tyrol at one point or another, which meant you needed very good clothing, you needed an adequate supply of food, you need some pretty good maps, and you had to know what was going to happen at the other end of it. If you got to the partisans and so on, great. There's a lot of uncertainty there, so you had to be pretty clear. So whilst your mind was constantly on the thought of escape, putting it into practice, I found much more difficult thing to do, because it did not seem logical. You might say, well, it's a bit gutless to say it's not logical. Well, I don't think it was gutless. I think it was being a practical appreciation of the circumstances. You know, I was fighting war, but I still wanted to live, and I didn't want to throw my life away trying to climb the Tyrol or something like that. In camp itself, you asked how we passed the time. In a range of activities which were very beneficial, and one was reading, which I mentioned, and was with reading, as you know, it gives you the opportunity for discussion, and so you seek out, if you're lucky, people with whom you can discuss some of these things. And the very fact that you were thinking about them and talking about them. And I think that the opportunity of being a POW is that it gave me something that so few people really have in their lives. It gave me some pretty serious experiences, followed by 3 years sitting on my backside with not much else to do but think, read and think. Now, how many people between those the ages of 18 and 23 can do that? They can really sit down, read good books, and just be able to think them through, think their thoughts through. So, again, quoting Shakespeare, as you like it sweet, are the uses of adversity. I was in a difficult situation, but it did have value, and that's what I look to most, the value of it. There are other things as well. For example, I went through the practice of each night I would seek out somebody in the camp that I wanted to talk with, somebody of a different occupation or different personality or something. I would literally think about somebody and try and select that person. And I'd go for a walk around the compound with them. And round in this, I can see it now, this oval walk. And I'd just ask them about their lives and so on and get them talking about themselves. And the things I learned of other people's backgrounds, how they lived, what they did for a living and so on, and some of their experiences have been still are very strong in my mind. For example, one English sergeant, a more mature man, well, quite a mature man, his responsibility was up there fixing girders of new buildings in England, in London, and so on, through the winter, when it's up there on these slippery, icy bits of metal, trying to get two beams together to put a bolt through in the bitterly... You know, if you think about it, I know it's going on all over the world, but normally one doesn't think of this thing, these things too often, of what people do with their lives. And many, many more, although I won't go into all of them. And I also mentioned the reading I was doing with Nietzsche and Plato and Aristotle and a whole range of... As you can see, my reading was sort of quite eclectic and dealing with the centre of man surrounded by what is his life and history and so on. Within the camp itself, life did deteriorate. It was a small, a big camp. It was a camp of, I understand, 20,000 prisoners, most of whom were Russians, with whom we had no contact at all. We would see them marching down a road on the other side of our wire, between our wire and the Salsats in Markvangel. We were right on the River Salsats, which flows down through Salzburg. And down this path would constantly be Russians coming through. Now, the Russians were given a bad time. The Germans gave the Russians a bad time in Russia, in advancing to Russia. The Russians, in turn, gave the Germans a bad time. And in the camp was pretty obvious that bad time hadn't stopped for the Russians and the Germans were the tops. As they walked past on one day, we just had a Red Cross parcel in and I had a cake of English soap. Now, that's all I had. And I threw it over the fence because I imagined that somebody would have a nice piece of English soap. To my surprise, but I've heard that this has happened to other people too, the fellow picked it up, took off the wrapper and put it in his mouth to eat it. And when in reflection and greater knowledge, when I think of the sort of soap that Russian peasants, you might say, would have, I just imagine a little bit of English, beautifully wrapped English soap. That's beside the way. We had very little contact with them next door. The most striking memory I have is an argument between two prisoners, an Italian and a Frenchman, both very agitated. That was really quite a pantomime. The food was got very, very difficult there in Germany. The same thing applied. The horse, the soups made of grasses, potatoes, beans, not all at once, but these were what the meal consisted of. You only had the one meal a day. And it got pretty light. Certain things would creep in. For example, the potatoes would be brought in their jackets, cooked by our people, our being the British, British, Australians, whatever, all under the term of British. And then each hut would go and get its collection of... Oh, no, they'd put them in the soup. That's right. Now, it's very interesting that the potatoes would be one meal, potatoes and water, water's top soup. Then you'd have beans, lentils, beans in water, soup. And another occasion, you'd have meat, perhaps with a bit of green in it, as a soup. They were probably the three stable diets, stable serve. Now, with food, you'd have friends, people with mates. Okay, you've got maybe three or four mates. Usually they go and say, have two mates, one would have two Dixies. We use the Italian Dixies, which are ours.
Sorry, continue.
Open the top and deeper, and they also have a lid that can fit over the top of that, and with a handle, and so you could have two in one hand and two in the other. So people got themselves into groups of four, and they'd line up for their meal, and there'd be a scoop of food, and it would be put into the can. Now you could watch them. If it was there, each person had his own Dixie, of course, and if there was a little bit extra bit of meat hanging over or something like that, they'd swing their Dixie in. And if it was poor sort of a serve, they'd swing the other person's Dixie in. So consequently, as food got harder, then you saw the fours breaking up into twos, the two closer mates. And then when it got harder still, each man would go and collect his own. And then it got to the point, and if ever I have received any sort of pleasure, it was from the unusual thing of being asked if I would personally serve the food. And I accepted, and I did. Now, there's a little bit of an art to this, because firstly, whatever you were stirring, sometimes the product would sink to the bottom, so you'd have to stir it in a circle downwards and upwards. Another time, you'd do it in a, around the top circle. And in any case, I would get a scoop and hold it up to the person with a Dixie, and say, happy, and he'd say, happy. So I'd tip into his bowl. If he said, unhappy, I'd give him another scoop. Happy, right. And then there's always some left over. So instead of all people rushing their meal and the first getting back to get a little bit of the bunce, as we call it, I've developed a queue for the bunce queue. So they take it in turns. And there'd be a bunce queue, say, for potatoes, a bunce queue for the beans, and a bunce queue for the meat. So everybody had their fair share, and it's good that we had no further problems. Now, the bread rolls, the black bread, came out in sort of a round pad, and it started off being 1 for 5, then it went 1 for 7, and eventually finished up 1 for 14, so the serve got pretty small. So it became like the potatoes. We found that the cookhouse were peeling the potatoes and making the skins too thick. And so we were getting smaller potatoes, and then they'd be selling the skins back to us. So we decided that we would get the potatoes half-cooked and given to us in their jackets. So then we had to separate them to see that each man got his equal portion. So you'd finish up with your little group, and you'd go through the potatoes, the biggest down, then back the other way to this, keep running them down until each one was sort of, and then you'd put a portion, and then you put a card, a playing card, against each one, and they'd come in and you'd offer them these cards that they couldn't see, and they'd take a pick, and the one that they picked was the one the little heap of line of potatoes they got. They might say these things so trivial, but food was so short, it was quite critical.
The Russians had sort of turned things around from July 43. What were the feelings then that you could sense from your German captors as things started to look more desperate for them?
It's quite interesting when you ask that question, because I can feel in my mind a change of attitude. And remember, both these camps, Spital und Rauhmarkt-Plongau, were in Austria. The guards generally were older, and they were Austrian older, so they had a different philosophy, different mentality to the younger young German, what's their name, the Hitler's Youth. Hitler Youth. And I think a lot of them wanted the war to be over anyway. And I think that, whether it's my imagination, but I have a feeling there's an element of truth in it, that a lot of them wanted the war to end anyway. I think they're aware that how their cities were being bombed, and I think they're developing their attitude to Hitler and so on. And a lot of the Austrians didn't have the same rigid mentality. I'm not talking about all of them, a lot of them certainly did. So there was a difference there. So it's very hard to speak en masse of all the guards, because the guards also would change. You get different groups of guards coming in from different places, and sometimes with different attitudes. So I guess it could be best interpreted not how we saw them, because we weren't speaking to them. Well, speaking to them, now this is very interesting in perhaps in Spittal with a couple of other warrant officers, we were looking after the distribution of the Red Cross parcels when they came in. And each person had his parcel with his name on it, and he'd come in and ask for his parcel, you'd bring it down, he'd select what he wanted from it, you'd get the can opened, and you'd hand it to him, opened. Now there's a German sergeant major called a Spies, which is, means mother of the company, big fellow, just like Sergeant Schultz. If you know Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes, you can picture this bloke. And this fellow used to come in, he was quite a genial sort of a bloke. And he'd say, tell him about the, there are a number of women down, there is a hut with full of Russian women. And I'll tell you, they do not have a hair on their body. Well, this is great. So anyway, he got in, started enjoying little sayings. Give me a saying. What do you say? What would I? And I said, you jerk your gherkin. You jerk your gherkin. What do you mean by that? You pull your pud. Pull, jerk your gherkin. Pull your pud. What is that? So I described it to him more fully. Ah! Ah! You jerk your gherkin. So an Englishman came in, a young Englishman too, and he was collecting his parcel, and this fellow, the sergeant major, said to him, you jerk your gherkin. The poor little pummy blushed, and he said to him, and what's more, you're as ugly as a hatful of arseholes. The kid took his can and ran. But another, this is even best of all, even if you scrub it from the tape, I've got to tell you this. This fellow had the camp on parade, and he said, what do I say to dismiss these men? And our camp leader said, fuck off. So he yelled out, fuck off! It brought the house down. Even if that doesn't pass the tape, it was one of the highlights of that camp.
I assume that these occasions obviously helped to keep the morale of the prisoners up.
Yes.
What are things like the thoughts of home?
Oh, the thoughts of it's interesting to observe the cycle of the mind. So the highs and the lows, and the interesting thing I find is that we still have these in daily life. You have to be a prisoner for them. Your body rhythms can be high or low. Often, when we're on a high, we feel terrific. We wake up in the morning and we want to get stuck into the day, and we think clearly and better. That's when all the biorhythms are running high. If they're running low, it's a rotten place, and if everything is, the world has got me snouted just a treat, to use a Dennis slogan. So, but you could see that particularly in camp life, where you're dealing with the same people every day, every day, every day, and the same scenery every day, and pretty much the same food every day. And you'll find it in yourself that you go through a period, a black period, and the war is never going to end, and you're going to be fearful, you might never get out of it, and it's like, say, a bad thought 3 o'clock in the morning. not despair, sort of despair, I suppose, but definitely a dead thought, black thought. And you feel it's a long time, you're never going to get away, never get home. Well, it just seems to be going on and on. And you'll see fellows with it, that they get into a black mood, and invariably towards the end of, not the beginning, at the beginning they become argumentative and you'd see a lot of arguments developing. But over a period of time, even without discussing it, people would learn to understand. A fellow would be in a black mood and he'd go and stand at the wire and he'd just stand there by himself and he'd look out and look out day after day for a while, a week, fortnight, whatever it would take him to work through it. And then somebody else would take it. And the hardest thing was for people who had lost their wives or heard that their wives were racing out with somebody else or their wives wanted a divorce. And it was happening and they took that very, very hard. I think that would be the hardest thing of all. I really am very grateful for the fact that I was a young single man and didn't have to face that sort of thing. I think it'd be horrific to go through all of that, be separated, thinking only of getting home to your wife and family, and to hear that she's been wants a divorce, racing off with somebody else. But it happened, and understandable, I guess.
How often would you get news from her?
Well, I suppose in memory, sort of regularly in a spasmodic type of way, if that describes it. That there could be sort of some sort of regular flow. I really, in memory, can't say. Sometimes it would come in regularly, other times it would be a long time between letters, and then you might get a few. We would get, I think, again from memory, and it's a long memory now, two cards, I think a card a fortnight, and a sort of a one-page type fill-in letter. I think one of those a month. Two cards and one of those a month, I think it would be, that we would send. But it would take often some time, and they would be checked out before they went, of course.
What sorts of things would you write about being a prisoner of war? What could you say?
Not much. Not much. In fact, my parents kept all my letters, and I've got them down there, and I haven't got round to reading them yet. One day, when I retire, I'll get round to going through it, I guess. No matter what I did say, but you couldn't tell much. You couldn't say much at all. Usually, it had to be a buoyant thing, feeling okay, doing this, doing that, whatever, reading this, reading that. And when you felt that you really were getting serious about escaping, I'd try and give them veiled messages. I'd use my nickname and say, well, somebody with it, I hear his horse is getting closer to the barrier, so he might have a victory or whatever.
What would people write to you?
Well, I think I find now, with the greatest of good intent and humour, a letter from an old mate of mine, whom I still have lunch with 60 years later, every Friday, wrote to me saying, go easy on the vitamins. Now, for whatever reason, I took that in the wrong light. Go easy on the bloody vitamins. Now, there's this fellow in the army here, and also in the army, and enjoying life, and go easy on the vitamins. Of course, it was his sense of humour, but I didn't take it that way. Perhaps it was vitamins were too hard to get then. Now, just to reiterate on that situation of food, that it's pretty obvious that we got food readily in the summertime, when the railway lines were freer, and produce was more plentiful and so on. Movement was much easier. But particularly in the winter, when they were wanting to get their weapons and equipment and reinforce themselves up to the front line for their own spring offensives and to resist the enemy's spring offensives, that all their rolling stock and vehicles and so on were all occupied in transporting troops and equipment and ammunition. The last thing in their minds was to get food to the prisoners. We were far down the totem pole. And that was one of the reasons food became extremely difficult. And we did go through, particularly in that last winter, which was a pretty cold winter anyway, as I recall, the food was so scarce that one became totally skinny. I might have mentioned earlier that all the veins in my stomach, there was no fat there, the veins would just stand out like cords. I didn't know there were so many veins in one stomach without thinking about it, and no fat on the backside, so that you'd sit and you'd be sitting on two bones that you couldn't sit for very long. And you, when you pumped up water to throw over yourself, you'd be cold for the rest of the day, you didn't have enough energy at all, and so on. That was a pretty difficult time.
You mentioned that you'd received Red Cross parcels. Were there any inspections of the camps at all?
Yes, talking of the Red Cross parcels and connecting it with what I've just been discussing, food got so bad at one stage that they sent the Swiss Red Cross sent a special convoy of white trucks, we called them White Angels, with food for the prisoners, because they knew the prisoners were starving. And they got a shipment to our camp, and no doubt others, presumably all, or I don't know the extent of what they did, but these white trucks of the International Red Cross came up with the Red Cross parcels. Now, this might be a little bit boring too. I probably shouldn't waste time telling you this, but to give you an idea of the mental attitude, there was I won't tell you, I think it'll waste time.
Continue.
This was an Australian sub-major from New South Wales, an older fellow, probably around about the late 30s or early 40s, something. A bank manager in Sydney. And was the Red Cross parcel, so he said he would collect it. Now, there were different categories. The English was considered quite well, the New Zealand not bad. The best was the Canadian Red Cross parcel. So he went, we had to share one between two. And he managed to get a Canadian, just by luck, not good judgment. So he brought it back and he said, for getting a Red Cross parcel, he said, I'm entitled to something here. And so he opened the biscuits and he said, now, if there are 13 biscuits here, I get the extra one. There were 12. The prunes. Now, if there are 25, an uneven number, I get the extra one. There were 24. There wasn't much else to split, so he opened a tin of sardines. I think there were about five sardines, seven or something like that, sardines in it. He took out one sardine, and he said, well, before we split the rest, he said, that's for me, to getting the Red Cross parcel. And I thought, well, you've put a price on yourself of half a sardine, and that's about all you're worth. I didn't say that, that's what I thought. But what it does indicate, it indicates how tight food was and how people were really had to look after themselves.
Were the Red Cross in any position, really, to do anything about bad conditions in prisoner of war camps anyway?
Not to my knowledge. I really can't answer that. I don't know. No doubt they were doing what they could, where they could. But I expect also that, particularly Germany, being in the condition that it was in, was struggling to keep afloat, and possibly listening to the Red Cross, I imagine, listening to the Red Cross with one ear and ignoring them with the other.
So what were you hearing at this time about the situation in other parts of Europe in regard to the war?
We're now moving into the last stages of the war, I presume. I mentioned earlier about D-Day, and that was memorable, with these waves of bombers coming over. The British bombed by night, and their planes were black. The Americans were high-level bombers that flew by day, and theirs were silver. So it was easy to know where these planes were coming from. And they would come, they would circle over, the area where we were, and then they'd move off either to Linz or Berchtesgaden or Munich or wherever. And they seemed to use the area that we were, the mountain, whatever it was, as a focal point to direct. But these waves and waves of bombers, it's unbelievable that the sky could be so filled for so long with so many, in turn, black and silver planes coming in. God help them. I feel very sorry for the Germans.